Thank you. Thank you for having me, and you can never be too Jewish.
Shalom. Welcome to the Too Jewish radio show and podcast with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. Get ready for a great hour together, news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, Rabbi's guest, Professor Samuel G. Friedman, author and journalist on the 25th anniversary of his book, Jew vs. Jew, The Struggle for the Soul of American Jewry. And we'll have a visit from Tom Price, our expert on the international Jewish scene. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom and an early Lashana Tova L'Chilonim, a happy secular new year. Or as Israelis say, happy Sylvester, which only makes sense if you've lived in Israel or know a lot of Israelis. That's what they say instead of happy new year, happy Sylvester, since the Jewish new year was actually back in September at Rosh Hashanah, not coming up now in January. There are a number of New Years, in fact, in Jewish tradition. Rosh Hashanah is the most familiar. Rosh Hashanah, the famous Mishnah at the beginning of the tractate, teaches us that that is the new year for counting years and for calculating the sabbatical and jubilee years. Rosh Hashanah is, of course, also the new year for the soul, the day of judgment, when we take account of our actions and seek to repent our sins and return to goodness and holiness. The appropriate time for New Year's resolution is definitely Rosh Hashanah, not January 1st. Now, the other New Year's delineated in traditional Jewish sources include the beginning of the springtime month of Nisan in late March or early April, actually, this year, which was the New Year's for governmental affairs in ancient times and the New Year for holidays, making Passover, Springtime Freedom Festival, the first holiday of the year, not Rosh Hashanah, oddly. Then there's Tu Bishvat, according to the Mishnah, the new year for trees that's coming up February 2nd, by the way, when our ancestors believed that sap began to flow in the trees in midwinter in the Northern Hemisphere, a kind of environmentally conscious new year. Finally, there was a tax new year, our ancestors' version of April 15th, which occurred about a month before Rosh Hashanah. Four Jewish New Years. That's not counting some later ones that could be tallied, like Simchat Torah, the new year for Torah, when we begin reading the Torah all over again at the end of the fall holiday cycle. Now, four New Years may impress you as about three too many, so what were Jews to do with yet another New Year at the end of December going into January? In Israel, they called it Sylvester, a semi-holiday reflecting the ambivalence of our Jewish culture to adopt yet another New Year's festival. Actually, Israelis calling New Year's Eve and day Sylvester is more than a bit bizarre. The name Sylvester does not come from the cartoon cat of Tweety Bird fame, but rather from the name of the saint and Roman pope who reigned during the Council of Nicaea in the year 325 CE. While that's obscure enough, there is a dark side to that guy, Sylvester. The year before the Council of Nicaea in 324 CE was Pope Sylvester who convinced the Roman Emperor Constantine to prohibit Jews from living in Jerusalem. And then at the Council of Nicaea, Sylvester thoughtfully arranged for the passage of a host of viciously anti-Semitic legislation, all of which was later incorporated into nearly every anti-Jewish legal code in the Byzantine Empire, and then throughout Western civilization for all time. So why do Israeli Jews celebrate a day dedicated to a vicious anti-Semite who did serious and enduring damage to our people some 1,700 years ago? Well, since all Catholic saints are awarded a day on which Christians pay tribute to that saint's memory, and December 31st is technically St. Sylvester Day, celebrations on the night of December 31st are dedicated to Sylvester's memory, officially. Now, that's not a guy you'd think Jews would ever wish to commemorate. Look, the way we Americans celebrate New Year's is also not so Jewish. Too much champagne, odd bits of food, firecrackers, fireworks, and an old Scottish song, a giant ball dropping in Times Square, all followed the next morning by parades and football games and hangover cures. These don't capture the essential Jewish messages of the need to improve ourselves and the world. Now, do they? Still, it's never a bad idea to make resolutions to improve and to seek to have a better year in the coming one, 2026. And so, here to play us in this morning is a lovely setting of the prayer Keter Melucha, the Kabbalistic poem about God's majesty that seems appropriate for beginning a new year, sung by the group Ayelet HaShachar, the early dawn.
Tamid yigdal Hashem Via et ayuham avdecha Viva ushim kibodecha Via gidu ba'i tzikecha Via et ayuham
That was the group Ayelet HaShachar singing Keter Melucha. We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Professor Samuel Friedman is a prominent American author, journalist, longtime professor at Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. He is the author of a number of books, but what we're going to like to talk about today is perhaps his most famous Jewish book, Jew versus Jew, originally published, I think, 25 years ago. And we'll kind of want to re-examine some of those important themes today. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thanks so much for having me, Rabbi. It's great to be back with you.
I need to note that I'm sure we both look the same and are very young, but the last time I had you on was 19 years ago. So it's great to have you back.
I'm back with a lot less hair.
Yeah. I'm not going to make any comments about my physical state since this is all, you know, just audio. I sound the same, I'm sure. The book Jew versus Jew was extremely important, I think, for the way that the American Jewish community thinks about itself. Tell us a little bit about what led to the creation of that book.
I, partly in my own, you know, life as an observant Jew and partly with the journalistic part of my brain, by the late 1990s was just seeing a set of different issues that seemed to be divisive within the American Jewish community. And I was looking for a way, rather than treating them, you know, as separate magazine articles at shorter length, if they could be part of a more cohesive look at what had happened. And eventually I came to realize that what held them all together was this unique kind of challenge that American Jewry had in the post-World War II years, which was what would it mean to be truly accepted by a country in the diaspora, which was something that Jews in the diaspora had never experienced before, and what would be the challenges and some of the tension points then of having to define what it meant to be Jewish and to be a good Jew and to be in a Jewish community and what constituted a good Jewish community if those conditions weren't largely set as a result of external forces of oppression and persecution and bigotry. And so that was really the hunt I went on in putting together Jew versus Jew.
You know, it's funny, but people still have certain ideas about the Jewish community that predate that. All Jews are this or all Jews are that, but all Jews are really not anything anymore, are they?
I think they never have been. I mean, it's always been a really varied community. All you have to do is read back into our, you know, sacred texts and back into antiquity to know that there was always debate, there was always disputation, there were points of really internal civil war. My initial title for Jew versus Jew, when I was writing the book proposal for it, was The Second Temple, because I was evoking, as I ended up doing in the text of the book itself, under its much better ultimate title of Jew versus Jew, the idea of Sinat Hinam, and our understanding of Jews, what caused the Second Temple to be destroyed, that, you know, that while the Romans may have been the ones who actually did the demolition, it was Jewish disunity that allowed the Romans to take advantage.
You know, that Jewish disunity has not lessened in these 25 years. When you look back on Jew versus Jew and the experience that you saw, does it seem that the polarization has become more acute? It does so to me, and I've been kind of working in that.
I agree. It does seem more acute. And when I've had a lot of occasion, including this podcast, to think about what's different a quarter century later. And one of the big points is that my operating assumption about American exceptionalism in terms of the lives of its Jewish population, that no longer feels like it's the case for me. And I even felt, I wrote an op-ed for Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, on the morning after Donald Trump was elected in 2016. And I said, this is the end of American exceptionalism for me. And I meant it both as a proudly patriotic American citizen, but also meant it as an American Jew. Because even in that first campaign, there was a lot of salience to using terms like globalist, for instance, and trying to demonize someone like George Soros. And these were no longer the kind of dog whistles in fringy campaigns. These were explicitly said in a victorious major party campaign. And so I think that has continued apace, you know, in the MAGA movement from the right, as we're seeing right now, the idea that someone like Nick Fuentes and his wingman, Tucker Carlson, have legitimate places within the MAGA movement and the Republican Party today. So that really, I'm not happy as an author to say that some of my premises have been, you know, contravened by reality in the last 25 years, but that's happened from the right. And obviously the deep divide, particularly on the left around Israel, you know, in the aftermath of the Hamas invasion and massacre, and then the Gaza war with the enormous number of deaths and casualties in that. And the fact that, you know, when I was writing Jew versus Jew, and there's a whole chapter in there about the peace process, which seemed to be streaming along towards fruition when I was writing that book in 99 and early 2000, and I was projecting what would it mean for Jewish unity or disunity in this country once an agreement was made that seemed imminent to have a Palestinian state. And instead, with the Second Intifada, the peace process collapsed, the peace camp in Israel and really in the U.S. as well was totally undermined by events. And, you know, now we've come 25 years later to this very deep generational divide among American Jews over Israel and over Zionism. And that's something that in that way I hadn't seen. You know, when I was working between 2006 and 2016, writing a column on religion for the New York Times, at one point, I don't know, probably, I'm guessing 2012, 13, 14, somewhere in there, maybe a little bit later, I wrote an article about this group that seemed vestigial called the American Council for Judaism, which had been the anti-Zionist Jewish group of consequence back in pre-statehood days. And it was mostly a group of the Yekkes, the German Jews, people of classical Reformed Judaism who believed, you know, America is our promised land, so we don't want to look like we're culpable for dual loyalty. We don't need there to be a Jewish state. And by the time I was writing in the 2010s, this group was this remnant of its former self, which had never been a majority opinion anyway. But that was really down to almost complete insignificance. And jump ahead into 2023, 24, 25, and groups like If Not Now and Jewish Voice for Peace, particularly for certain subsets of young American Jews, have suddenly become a very, very active and significant part of the intra-Jewish debate. And that was also something I did not see coming when I was writing in 99 and 2000.
We will talk much more with Samuel Friedman, Jew versus Jew, but about the contemporary Jewish world when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established 7 years ago by wonderful congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Our new semester of the religious school is available for school-age kids and grandchildren. Join us. Hebrew school, Barn Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, and teen programs. All in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Come Friday night, 6:30 p.m., Shabbat evening services, always followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m., services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Or come to services on our Facebook page. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those through the website, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, Torah Tikes programs, Barn Bat Mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675, that's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing and most dynamic Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So Jews know a lot about immigration. We have been immigrants and emigrants from virtually every country on earth, usually kicked out of one and found our way into another. So immigration is very close to the Jewish heart.
Absolutely. I think part of our national origin story is being slaves in the land of Egypt, which was a country other than our own. We were strangers, we were outsiders, we were oppressed, and every year at Passover we celebrate our liberation from Egypt, but also leaving Egypt was sort of the beginning of Jewish history as opposed to world history, and it's why it's all the more confusing to me that many Jews are swept up into the current obsession with immigration and immigrants, and I mean, it seems to me there could be no less Jewish position than opposing immigration. We live in a country that was built by immigrants. In this season, we are bombarded constantly by Christmas music, 80 or 90% of which was written by Jewish immigrants, some of whom couldn't speak English, and one of whom, famously, couldn't read music, but could write it and compose it, and some of the most successful Christmas songs of all times were written by
Irving Berlin.
Jewish immigrants,
yeah.
who couldn't read music.
Couldn't read a note of music, and had a strong accent, by the way, too.
When he finally learned to speak some English, right.
Everybody in this country is an immigrant, like literally, and it's just a question of how many generations you want to go back. Even the Native Americans came across on a land bridge 10,000 years ago, which in the general prehistory of the world, not very long ago, but certainly for the rest of us all came here. That notion that we made this country what it is, like that, it's based in immigration.
Yeah, I mean, it's also interesting that the poem on the Statue of Liberty was written by a Jewish immigrant, a Malazarus.
Right.
You're tired, you're poor, you're huddled masses yearning to breathe free. That was the history of our country until very recently.
It's an important thing to remember now and always. And it's funny to talk about it because I'm pretty sure a lot of people's number one Christmas songs is Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire by Mel Torme, whose parents were both immigrants from Eastern Europe.
I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas.
Right, right. Tom, thanks so much. And a happy secular new year. And we will talk in 2026.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The last one for 2025. Abe is eating lunch at the deli and he notices a very elderly couple at the next table. They have one plate with a corned beef sandwich and potato salad, one cream soda, and an empty glass. The old man carefully divides the sandwich in half, then separates the potato salad into two little piles, pours the drink into the empty glass in front of his wife, and then begins to eat while his wife just watches, her hands folded in her lap. Abe is saddened and concerned. He solicitously offers to buy them another corned beef sandwich. They don't have to split theirs. The old man explains, oh no, that's unnecessary. Very kind, unnecessary. We've been married for 60 years now. We share everything 50-50. Always. So Abe asks the old lady, why aren't you eating? And she answers, it's his turn with the teeth. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish. Just for you, you should live and be well and share the teeth. And now a word of Torah. This week we complete the great story of Joseph and of his father Jacob, also known as Israel, with the final Torah portion of the book of Genesis called Vayechi. It begins by describing the death of Jacob, and perhaps even more importantly, the final blessings that Jacob gives to his many sons. One of the most interesting aspects of this section is a brief episode in which Joseph, who knows that his father is dying, brings his own two sons, Jacob's grandsons, Ephraim and Manasseh, to him for a blessing. In keeping with an ongoing theme in Genesis, Jacob blesses the younger son, Ephraim, before the older one, Manasseh. When Joseph tries to correct his dad, Jacob assures him this blessing order is intentional. Both boys will father great tribes, but the younger will exceed the older in accomplishment. We still use this very blessing each Friday night when we bless our own sons today, both in temple and at home. In the Bible, we always expect the older child to succeed at a greater level than the younger, to receive a bonus, I guess, for being firstborn. But repeatedly throughout Genesis, the younger child is the one who ends up excelling the older and receiving a greater portion of inheritance. There's a clear message here. God has a plan that goes beyond the conventions of human society. As Paul Simon once sang, God only knows, God makes his plan, the information unavailable to the mortal man. For us, this consistent reversal of traditional roles teaches a different lesson. In the negative formulation, Shakespeare has Caesar say, the fault, dear Brutus, lies not in our stars, but in ourselves. We can't attribute our own failures to birth order or horoscopes or even our parents. Life happens. But how we respond to it, that's up to us. What we can do is control our own actions and our own choices. We each have the ability to shape our destinies. Like Ephraim or like Joseph himself or his own father Jacob, we may be born into less favor and fortune than others, but we can make our own way to success and goodness and to God if we work and care and continue to seek holiness. We'll return in a moment on Too Jewish, our guest, Samuel Friedman, author of the powerful book Jew vs. Jew, The Struggle for the Soul of American Judaism, which came out 25 years ago, tells us how that struggle has gone and discusses where we are now. All that when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohai.
In Britain, two aspiring terrorists were found guilty last week of plotting to kill hundreds in an Islamic State-inspired gun rampage against the Jewish community in England, a planned attack demonstrating the resurgent risk posed by the terror group. Police and prosecutors said Walid Sadoui, 38 years old, and Amar Hussein, 52, who went on trial a week after an unrelated murderous attack on a synagogue on Yom Kippur in the nearby city of Manchester, were Islamic extremists who wanted to use automatic firearms in order to kill as many Jews as they could. Had their plan come to fruition, it would have resulted in one of, if not the, deadliest terror attack in UK history, said Assistant Chief Constable Robert Potts, who's in charge of counterterrorism policing in northwest England. Their convictions come little more than a week after the anti-Semitic mass shooting at a Hanukkah celebration on Sydney's Bondi Beach, in which 15 people were murdered. The Islamic State said the Australian attack was a, quote, source of pride. Although the jihadist group did not claim responsibility, its response has heightened fears of an increase in violent Islamist extremism. Sadui arranged for 2 assault rifles, an automatic pistol, and almost 200 rounds of ammunition to be smuggled into Britain through the port of Dover when he was arrested in May of 2024, the prosecutor said. He added Sadui planned to obtain 2 more rifles, another pistol, and collect at least 900 rounds. Unknown to him, a man known as Farouk was trying to get the weapons from was an undercover police operative. Sadu said the assault rifles Sadui wanted were similar to those used in a 2015 Islamist terror attack on the Bataclan concert hall in Paris that murdered 130 people. He added Sadui hero-worshipped Abdelhamid Abaoud, the monster terrorist who coordinated that attack. Meanwhile, in Canada, 3 Toronto men were arrested by police last week for attempted kidnappings targeting Jews and women. Waleed Khan, Osman Azizov, 18 years old, and Fahad Sadat, 19, of Toronto, face over a dozen charges, including 2 counts of sexual assault with a weapon and 2 counts of attempted kidnapping with a firearm, according to the Toronto Police Service. Khan was separately charged with multiple terrorism offenses, including providing property to fund ISIS and conspiring to commit murder on behalf of a terrorist group, according to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. These arrests stem from an investigation into 2 failed kidnappings perpetrated by the men several months ago. The attempted kidnapping stemmed in part from hate-motivated extremism, according to Toronto police, who said they found evidence in the suspect's home that they were particularly targeting women and members of the Jewish community. These arrests were welcomed by Noah Shack, the CEO of Canada's Centre for Israel and Jewish Affairs, who warned the recent terror attack in Sydney showed we are one intelligence failure away from a devastating loss of life. It's alarming that multiple Islamic State-related terrorist plots have been uncovered over the past 2 years in Canada, Shack said. This goes far beyond the safety of any one group. It's a matter of national security and public safety. There is a ticking time bomb in our country that our leaders must confront before it's too late. In September 2024, a Pakistani man was arrested in Quebec for plotting to kill as many Jewish people as possible in an attack in support of ISIS in New York. Months later, a father and son were arrested in Toronto for planning an ISIS-inspired attack on the local Jewish community. And in Poland, the director of Warsaw's Jewish cemetery has been fired following a dispute over restoration projects at the site. He said they often were excluding local Jews. Witold Ruszynski, the Jewish director, was pushed out December 10th after seeking a new contract with the Polish Cultural Heritage Foundation, which controls public funds for works in the Warsaw Cemetery. The cemetery languished in neglect for decades after World War II. Only recently, it has become the center of efforts to preserve the history of Poland's Jews. Ruszynski manages the cemetery's operating budget for the local Jewish Community Board, but many restoration projects depend on public funds invested by something called the Cultural Heritage Foundation. That foundation is led by Michal Laszkowski, who has ties to the right-wing Law and Justice Party that governed Poland from 2015 to 2023 and backed Poland's newly elected president, a Holocaust revisionist that is a denier of the annihilation of Poland's Jews. The Law and Justice Party promotes historical narratives about Polish victimhood and resistance to the Nazis, but delegitimizes research on Polish anti-Semitism. 200,000 Jews are buried in the cemetery at the heart of Poland's capital of Warsaw. Founded in 1806 as one of Europe's largest Jewish cemeteries, holding generations of cultural luminaries, rabbis, and activists, along with 50,000 Jews murdered by the Nazis and consigned to 2 mass graves. A portion of the cemetery is active for the Jewish community currently living in Warsaw. We can only hope that this far right-wing influence won't bury the facts of Polish anti-Semitism. That's the 2 Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to 2 Jewish our guest this morning. Samuel G. Friedman is the author 25 years ago, it's hard to believe, of the book Jew versus Jew, which was such a vivid depiction of the many streams and really differences among the American Jewish community back then. You were speaking earlier about your original title for the book, which was Sinat Chinam, basically based on the concept of Sinat Chinam.
Having is going to be the title.
Yeah, the Second Temple, that because the destruction of the Second Temple, according to the Talmud, is ascribed to baseless hatred between Jews. Let's talk a little more about what's happened on the kind of left of, but more importantly, on the generational divide that you mentioned in the beginning of the show. That generational divide was certainly not predictable. We've had more efforts to connect young Jews with Israel, birthright programs, years abroad, summers in Israel, so many different efforts to bring Jews into close, American Jews, young American Jews into contact with Israel. Many of our synagogues and religious schools, Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, Reconstructionist, you name it, are focused on teaching Israel. And yet we now have Jewish camps focused on Zionist ideals. And now we have generation that, certainly not universally, but to a much larger degree, doesn't identify with Israel and identifies with other ideas.
Right.
Talk to us about that a little bit.
Well, look, there's always been a built-in tension in Judaism, which at other times has been a very productive, fertile tension between its particularistic and its universalistic applications. And that goes back to, you know, the oft-quoted, you know, teaching from Hillel, from the Talmud, right, about being for oneself, but also if I'm not for anyone else, then who am I for? So there's always been this sense of duality. And this was the idea of being a light unto nations and being a kingdom of priests, that wasn't supposed to only be about having the holiest and most moral polity within a Jewish sovereign nation or Jewish communities in the diaspora. It was also about setting a certain example that was supposed to be edifying and instructive for other peoples. So this is not an entirely new tension, although it's gotten extremely heightened. And I think that one of the things that, and you're totally right, by the way, your observations about there have been birthright, there are all kinds, there's gap year programs, kivunim, and all sorts of other things, you know, in the modern Orthodox world, the standard that you'll go and learn, you know, and learn in Israel for a year, post high school, pre-college, all those things have become better funded, probably more populated, more young American Jews participating in than ever in the past. And yet at the same time, we know this generational divide has really opened up. And your listeners, and I'm not saying this to commend what this polling found, but just to get a sense of how deep the divide is, the Washington Post a few months ago did a very lengthy, detailed poll on American Jewish opinion about Israel, about Zionism, about the Gaza War, that just came up with some startling results, even startling to me, who tries to keep tabs on these things, about how deep the generational divide was. I mean, some of it is a function of people's different ages and what has been their lived experience. I'm 70 now, so I'm of a generation that was about, you know, just shy of my bar mitzvah year when the Six-Day War took place, college freshman, when the Yom Kippur War took place, you know, father with young kids at the time of the Second Intifada and the Suicide War. And so if these were your touch points in your lived experience as an American Jew, it was going to build in a real affinity and bond to Israel. And also, if you were politically liberal, as we know from polling, the majority of American Jews are, you wanted to feel that liberal Zionism was characteristic of Israel as well, and that you could feel politically and morally consistent in your American liberalism and in your liberal Zionism. If you go to the typical college age or post-college young adult now, their lived experience has been primarily during the Netanyahu years, 15 of the last 16 or 16 the last 17 years, with the exception of the broad coalition government that you had with Yair Lapid and Naftali Bennett, but which only lasted for 1 year.
Right.
So their experience has been to look at Israel as being a politically very conservative country, a country that makes international alliances with people like Orban in
Hungary
and Modi in India and Trump in the United States, and is seen by them as part of kind of a more right-wing or authoritarian alliance around the world. And so that's a gigantic generational difference they see in Israel, that in spite of how it fell asleep at the gates and was surprise attacked by Hamas, leading to, you know, catastrophic results on October 7th, 2023, that overall has seemed like the military power in the region. And so that lived experience has been corrosive for maybe 40%, to go by the Washington Post polling, 50% of young American Jews. And here's the interesting thing, Rabbi. It used to be, and I would have subscribed to this at the time I was writing Jew versus Jew, that what you had among younger American Jews even then was that the more they knew about Israel, the more exposure they had had through going to day school, having a good Hebrew school program, gap year, family vacations, relatives and friends there, you name it, that they would be more attached. And that wasn't so much that another portion of younger Jews were opposed to Israel as much as disengaged. And the disengagement came out of a lack of connection, a lack of knowledge. And there's a really good book written by an Israel studies historian at UCLA named Dov Waxman. And maybe someone at your end can quickly Google the title of the book. I can't come up with it by memory. But in Dr. Waxman's book, which came out probably 6, 7, 8 years ago, he was drawing on polling that was starting to show that actually a lot of the most politically active critics of Israel, and even to the point of being anti-Zionist, that wasn't the case everywhere, but certainly being highly critical among young American Jews, were not the least knowledgeable, but the most knowledgeable.
Is that that book, Trouble in the Tribe, that he wrote?
I'm pretty sure that's the one. Yeah. Thank you. He was showing that there was a very different scenario, which is that young American Jews who were going in at that point into groups like J Street or into If Not Now, Jewish Voice for Peace really wasn't so much on his radar or really on the national radar at that point.
Right.
But in these other groups were feeling like, hey, I had this Jewish education. I did birthright. I visited my relatives and friends there. And I feel like the story I was told, which was really a liberal Zionist story, wasn't being matched by the reality of the ongoing occupation and by the nature of who was in power in Israel. This wasn't a Rabin government anymore, or Barak or Olmert. This was a longstanding, you know, Likud and kind of Haradal coalition there. If you know, I'm sure your listeners know the term Haradal, but if they don't, it's a portmanteau that translates out of Hebrew into being ultra-nationalist, ultra-Orthodox.
Right.
In any case, so they're reacting to that. And frankly, I was surprised as an observer of all these things that there wasn't kind of a rallying around the Magen David in the wake of the Hamas atrocity.
You would think so, wouldn't you? I mean, it was so horrific.
You would have thought so. And it happened. I remember vividly that was the case with the suicide bombing terror war of the Second Intifada.
Right.
It was very palpably the case. And it did not happen in this case. And I don't know if that's because deeper estrangement had predated it, or if this is also partly a function of things like the technologies that, for young people who are online, what they saw very early, after the war against Hamas began, was, you know, a steady stream of video coming out of Gaza showing not only, you know, Hamas casualties, but civilian casualties. And this goes back to the point I was making before about the universalist and particularist tension within Judaism, and even to telescope into specifically Holocaust education, which has been a gigantic effort, certainly not so much immediately post-Shoah, but in modern American Jewish history, you would date it to post-Eichmann trial in 1963, or certainly post-Six-Day War in 67, when a great deal of emphasis was put on Holocaust museums, Holocaust memorials, Holocaust education programs. And those programs have really magnified, compounded the tension. Is the lesson of Holocaust education, we've got to be ready as soon as we're endangered to defend ourselves as lethally as necessary? Or is it, as some of the Jews on the left put it, never again means never again for everyone? And those lines of interpretation have been really played out in the inter-Jewish and particularly inter-American Jewish friction post-October 7th, you know, the last 2 years and now, you know, 2 years and a month and a half or so. And I'll give you a couple of things that speak to that. One, in sort of the collective consciousness on we must always defend ourselves no matter what. I wrote one of my books called Who She Was, which I'll tell your listeners.
Right,
actually
I remember
newly
that book
republished,
well.
20th anniversary.
Yeah.
And it's the story of my mother's coming of age in this Jewish immigrant family in the Bronx from the late 30s to the early 1950s. And I wrote it because she died when I was quite young and I never knew about her. And I found this remarkable letter that her best friends had written to the best friend's boyfriend when he was fighting the Pacific War at the very end of World War II. And my mother and her friend Ruth had these Rosie the Riveter jobs in the defense plant in the Bronx. And by this time, the first newsreels of the death camps were showing up. Articles by American journalists in English were being written about the death camps. My mother had found out pretty reliably that all of the relatives on her maternal side, except for a handful who'd gotten out in the late 1930s to Uruguay, had all been exterminated. And my mom's friend Ruth describes in the letter to her boyfriend, her and my mom talking after work one day. They had to work a night shift and they wanted to take a break. And so Ruth says, well, Ellie and I were talking about what should we do with these Germans? You know, can they be fixed or do we need to kill them all? And we decided that we really do need to kill them all. And I think that that's part of the collective Jewish consciousness. And I really believe that after the Hamas surprise attack and the massacre and hostage taking, there was a switch that flipped in a part of the Jewish consciousness. And it was kind of actualized also by rhetoric that says Hamas is the Nazis. This, you know, numerically, yeah. This was the greatest day of Jewish death since the Shoah. So that's incontestably true.
It is.
But the rhetoric that said this is like the Nazis, I think, flipped that switch that my mother spoke to, which is that this is not a time to discern between civilian and not. This is a time to kill everyone. And I think that was enacted. And then on the other side of the Holocaust, I was a few weeks ago doing a Shabbaton at a wonderful conservative shul, Bethel, in Birmingham, Alabama.
Wow.
And I met someone in the congregation who, like a number of the congregants there, had been very involved in the civil rights movement in the 60s and very proud of it and saw that as a very Jewish thing to do, not only because Jews were often the targets of the Ku Klux Klan, as we know, but also because it felt consistent with its universalistic view of Judaism. And this person was telling me about their grandchild who had just been deported from Israel after doing solidarity work with a Palestinian village on the West Bank, defending their olive groves from attacks by settlers.
Right.
And that grandchild absolutely saw that work as being the consistent through line of what the grandparent had done. And that's a totally defensible historical and Judaic interpretation, too. So both of these examples, one that involves my own mother of blessed memory, and the other that involves this grandparent and grandchild, are kind of completely clashing with each other in the present intra-Jewish debate. And what makes the clash so deep is that each of them is absolutely historically, intellectually, and theologically defensible.
Which won't bring us closer together.
Which won't bring us closer together. Yeah, I agree.
And maybe it shouldn't.
I'll tell you something, Rabbi. Unfortunately, the editor, my longtime superlative editor, genius editor, Alice Mayhew, Simon & Schuster, passed away a number of years ago, because even before, you know, I passed away in 2020, so this was, you know, years before October 7th, but I wanted to update Jew versus Jew, because I had seen things in the Jewish community, and I date this particularly to the inter-Jewish debate about the Iran nuclear deal in 2015, that I really wanted to address in an updated version of the book, and unfortunately, for various reasons, it never got a commitment from Simon & Schuster that I could update it, because I felt it so needed to be brought up to date.
I look forward to that eventually coming out. I want to thank Samuel Friedman for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you and your current work?
I have a website, samuelfriedman.com, and there's a lot of info about myself and my books there, and all of my books are in print, the books I've written over my long career, and people can go to my favorite online bookselling site is a site called bookshop.org.
Okay.
So bookshop1word.org, and it's a great site. It helps support independent bookstores around the country. Thank you, Rabbi. Such a joy to be with you. Let's not wait 19 years before next time.
Please, God. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be next year, too. Our guest will be Ambassador Ronan Krauss, Israeli ambassador to the country of Azerbaijan. And join us, Congregation Beit Simcha, each Friday night. Services in Onig Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, live in person and on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning comes from cantor David Dudu Fisher, singing this song from the musical Joseph and His Technicolor Dreamcoat, Any Dream Will Do. May your dreams come true in 2026. My friends, have a great secular new year, a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
I closed my eyes, drew back the curtain to see for certain what I thought I knew.
Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona.
Someone was weeping, but the world was sleeping.